It's 9 o'clock, so I think we should start. We have a big group this semester, 36 people registered, so I guess more will come on, but we need to start. I received many emails, and I still have things I want to get to from previous classes last semester, so I'm going to put the last semester on hold for now, otherwise we'll get bogged down. I do just want to focus briefly, first on some comments about Tzitzis that people emailed me, and also the Vardic, about the Chazon Ish and Chaim Grad, and then return because we are with the Stipler on the Vardic. And no one reminded me to repeat the questions, as I was reminded by someone who listens to the tape, so I will try to remember to repeat the questions. I thank you, by the way. I don't know if he's here, Glenn, who sent me the Mishnah Brura, speaking about how everyone should wear talis gadol, even if you're not married. I contacted, because it's not in his book, Rabbi Hamburger, and he says he's planning on discussing that, but so far he hasn't. In other words, why only in the German community, basically among the Ashkenazim, that everyone wears it, and the Chafetz Chaim's position that even unmarried men should wear a talis gadol wasn't accepted any more than some other opinions of his. Although I'm surprised that today it hasn't achieved more acceptance, because a lot of the things we do are based on the Mishnah Brura. The truth is that, I don't know if I made this clear last time, this whole idea that we wear a talis gadol in davening, either married or unmarried, and the Mishnah Brura, if I'm not mistaken, mentions the Maharil giving a reason why it's only married, but in the days of the rabbis, of Chazal, used to wear this garment, and it's this around all the time. The Rambam even speaks about how you don't sell a garment which has tzitzis on it. It's only later on that people began just for davening. Even the phrase, talis gadol, and talis kata, that's a medieval phrase. You didn't have this expression. You don't have this expression anywhere in the Talmud. And this was only started to be used after people were not wearing a garment all the time. So then they started wearing tzitzis. In other words, they weren't wearing a long garment outside. Then you have some people who started wearing the smaller garment. In fact, the reason it's talis gadol, not talis katan, it should be talis gadola. It's a feminine word. If you look at the beginning of Bab Metzia, Shnayim Ochsim B'talis, correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't it say there, and they grab it, they refer to it as feminine? If this was a rabbinic expression, it would be a proper grammar, but in medieval times already, we know that with a tuf at the end, we often refer to these words as masculine, even though they are feminine. This point is made by Rabbi Meir Mazuz in one of his writings. Now, Shlomo wrote to me that he asked his Rav, should he make a bracha on the talis katan? Because the Mishnah Berurah says not to, although I did find sources that say the Mishnah Berurah is only referring to if you immediately plan to daven. But if you don't immediately plan to daven and you plan to walk around even for a short period of time, and Ramosha Feinstein says 20 minutes is the figure I have. I don't know if that's exact figure, if it's 10 minutes or 15 minutes, but the idea is you're not supposed to walk around without having tzitzis on. So if you're going to have any, if you're going to walk to shul or do something, that would seem to be a break. And it used to be people would sleep in the talis katan, so they would get up, and you couldn't make a bracha on it, so therefore the minhag was not to make a bracha on it. But today, where people would get up and you'd put it on before daybreak. But today, when you put it on, and you could be 10, 15, 20 minutes until you daven, as I said, you have this opinion out there that you do make the bracha. So for all those who do make the bracha, you also have the opinion out there that you don't make the bracha. So it's sort of like the dispute over do you make Havdalah before or after Hanukkah candles. Whatever you do, you're right. And whatever you do, you're wrong. Because whatever you do, you have plenty of big authorities. Ramosha's opinion, the Stipler opinion, who we're talking about, also says this, that if it's, you have a break of, let's say, 20 minutes, I think the figure he gives, or I don't know if he gives the exact, he just says that if you're going to have it on, if you're not going to daven immediately, then you should make the bracha over the talis katan. I can send you the link. Ramosha Feinstein, he asked the rabbi, there's a Rabbi Baruch Hirschfeld in Cleveland, and he asked this question to him, so it's an oral tshuva. It's not actually in his sefer. But you have, as I said, other rabbis who say that. So now, that's interesting that he says that. What I'm more interested, however, is why it hasn't taken off in the yeshiva world. The yeshiva world has adopted all sorts of practices in the Mishnah Berurah. Yisgadel, this the repetition of Zecher. This, all these go back to the Mishnah Berurah. Why Mishnah Berurah, who's become the posek for Ashkenazi Jewry today, certainly the yeshiva world, why that hasn't led to people in yeshivas wearing it? I think that's interesting. I don't know the answer to that. Okay, let me speak a tiny bit now about Nevardik and the Chazon Ish responding to questions. First of all, here's the book, Humus HaMusar. It's a cheap reprint I have. I have to correct a mistake I made. Someone asked me about the Aruch HaShulchan, who was the Rav of Nevardik, and I said that the Aruch HaShulchan's defense of the Nevardik yeshiva boys appears front and center. It's actually not true. First, you have the defense from the Barabatim, which may be more significant, because the Nevardik students were accused of being disruptive, of being problematic. So first you have, and this is on page 126 and 127, you have the leading Barabatim in Nevardik explaining how these are wonderful young men, and they don't cause any troubles, and we love to have them here. And only after that do you have the Aruch HaShulchan, who says, you know, that he affirms this, that these are wonderful, just like Eidus Nichbede HaBaalbatim DeMachanenu. And then you have another letter from the Dayanim in Nevardik. Glenn, I thank you. Glenn just came on. I thank you for calling my attention to this. If you missed the first 5 minutes, when you get the tape sent to you, you can hear it. Now, I do want to say a few more things about Nevardik, but also about Chaim Grada. I was asked last class, did he ever go to Israel afterward, after the Chazon Ish died? Because I said he couldn't go when the Chazon Ish was alive. He would have been too difficult. And I was certain that he did. And I was right, he did. But I forgot the most important thing, which I shouldn't have forgotten. But just a few words then about the Chaim Grada. We spoke about him when we dealt with the Chazon Ish. But he actually studied with the Chazon Ish for 7 years. That doesn't mean it was nonstop 7 years. It was on and off. They lived in Vilna. Chazon Ish was not known at this time. He would study, could go on for a week studying, and then Grada, there'd be a break for a few weeks. But that went on for 7 years until Grada was 23, and he decided to, he broke with the Chazon Ish. And he went and started associating himself with the secular writers. Now, those who have this book, the letters of the Chazon Ish, if you look in volume 1, in letter number 128, page 136, you have a letter from the Chazon Ish to someone he calls Bricha Minoar, the one who he had a bond from our youth. He says, he speaks in this little letter, he says, I didn't write to you for a while, but I just got your address, and I want to write to you, and it brings back thinking about our early years, the love that we had. And I want to, and he said, just having a short letter here. This is a letter to Chaim Grada. Apparently, Grada never replied to the letter. It's the only letter where the Chazon Ish writes this way, Bitcha Minoar. However, after the Chazon Ish died, Grada goes to Eretz Yisrael, and he goes to the Chazon Ish's grave, and he writes a poem. I forgot about this. I don't know how I forgot about it, but I forgot about it. A Yiddish poem, which is then translated into Hebrew. Here is the, by the way, the letter that I just referred to. It was published, believe it or not, by the journal in Israel, Beis Yaakov, which is an Aguda journal. In the succeeding issue, there are two letters from readers saying that there was a bizayon, it was a disgrace that they published this from Chaim Grada, because Chaim Grada is not a Chuzer B'tshuva, as this thing implies here. This is it published in 1969, and it was all about the Chazon Ish. So they published here the feelings of repentance of a student who went off the derech, as you could say. It doesn't say he's a Baal Tshuva, but I guess there's a bit of an implication. So there are two letters in the succeeding, and then there's a Hebrew translation of Grada's poem when he stood on Erev Shabbos Shuva on the kever of, it says, Moriva Rabbi. So Chaim Grada, he came to the Chazon Ish. He couldn't come to him during his lifetime, but he came to him after his death. So that answers that. Finally, Navardic. I was asked to say just a couple more words about it before we return to the Stipor in Navardic. Again, I misspoke. About 80% of what I say is off the cuff, so sometimes I misspeak. I describe Ben Arzi, that is Netanyahu's father-in-law's book on Navardic, as a memoir. It's not actually a memoir. It's based on his life, and it's a description of personalities in Navardic and what was Navardic was like. But I saw that he admits that he takes liberties with some descriptions. Now, obviously, Navardic, big thing was working on values, Shavirat Hamidot, destroying the bad traits. The big thing is, if you're interested, is to see David Fishman's article. I could send anyone who's interested a PDF. He speaks about the trends in Navardic, the pu'ulas, they called it, the actions that they would do to break their bad traits. Tries to argue that perhaps some of this is actually based on Russian society that were going on in wider society. Talks about the Navardic notion that the soul is under the control of evil passions. And he, as I said, you have to shatter your midos. Speaks about the strange things they would do, the sources, the rabbinic sources they would use, Kovos Lavavos, the Rambam Shmona Prakim, and how they would use it in a special way. The Rambam's idea that everyone really wants to do the right thing. This is in Hilchos Gerushin. We force him to do the right thing. We beat him till he gives a get to his wife. That shows that deep down underneath the surface, we really want to do the right thing. We just have to break it. He speaks in this article a bit about Rav Yosef Yoizel, who really broke with his family. He really had nothing to do with his family. He mentions that he lived as a hermit for a while, though he doesn't say that he lived in... Glenn, you have to send me an email and I'll send it to you. He doesn't mention that he lived as, not just as a hermit, but he lived in this room where one bowl for milchig, one for fleishig. And then the most interesting thing, that in a sense, the Navardikers were really bohemians. What were they doing? They were doing the exact same thing that the Russian masses, Russian youth were doing. People wanted to break away from the bourgeois mentality of their parents. Some were becoming revolutionaries, and the Vardikers sensed that they were different. Everything that was of value and importance to their parents, they were rejecting. They were living a different lifestyle. The whole idea of the Shena Yid, the idea of the beautiful Jew, the learned scholar, the prosperous merchant, they rejected all of these things. And finally, he speaks about how Navardic used technology. They used newspapers at the time. They had organizations, they had meetings, all these sorts of things. The other interesting thing, which I could send as well, is Moshe Silberg's memoir. Moshe Silberg, it's amazing. He writes about, he came from Slobodka, where he says people were normal. They sat around, they talked politics, they told a little Lashon Hara, they ate. I mean, and then you felt like you were normal there, and then he goes to Navardic. And his first day there, someone grabs him and says, "Where are you holding spiritually?" You know what to answer. What do you mean, where am I holding spiritually? And Silberg describes the strangeness about being there, the Vod. They had different groups that were called, each one was called a Vod, and they would get together, focus on Musar. That was something he had never seen before, never heard before. One other thing he mentions... Well, basically, he speaks about the idea of tikkun hamidot, how to fix yourself up. And that's really Navardic. And that's where we left off last time. And that's where the Stipor is. On the eve of World War I, there were over 300 students in Navardic and the branches. There was a few branches at this time, making it one of the largest yeshivas in Russia. And the Stipor remained at Navardic for approximately 8 years, through World War I, when the yeshiva was relocated to the Ukraine. In 1918, at the age of, he was 19 years old, the Rav Yosef Yoizel Horowitz asked the Sipor to lead one of the branches of the Navardic Yeshiva that had opened in the city of Rogachev. You know Rogachev, obviously, that's where the Rogachever comes from. Out here, I want to check on. The Rogachever is best known for being in Divinsk, but he comes from Rogachev. By 1919, there were 30 branches of the Navardic Yeshiva. Actually, when I said before, I misspoke as well. I said there was over 300 students in Navardic. I was speaking about Navardic itself, the Yeshiva of Navardic, where the Sipor ended up. Well, first he went to somewhere else. There were 30 branches of the Navardic Yeshiva, some quite small. Now, shortly after taking over this Yeshiva, at least this is how it's portrayed in the biography of the grandson. Other people portray it differently, different time period. According to the biography of the grandson, it was in 1918 that it into the army. 1918, this would make it the Red Army. Other reports speak of him being drafted into the Tsarist army. In fact, the grandson of the Sipor seems to be confused because he thinks 19, but he's certain about what year the draft is and what year he's taken into the army. And when he went to found this yeshiva, he's talking about the speak about the maiden of that 16. Not really important. What is important for us is that, as far as I know, this is the only Gadol Yisrael, great sage of Israel, who was ever, at least since medieval times, because you have Shmuel Hanagi and others who were in the Spanish army, but who was ever in army. Usually, these people, the learned, the rabbinic class, were able to get out of it. How they got out of it? They bribe someone. If worse, some doctor gave him a note for injury. If worse came to worse, and they couldn't get out of it, what they did was they would flee. Go to America, England, or somewhere. Almost always they were able to get out of it. This created problems. I wrote about this a bit. During Tsar Nicholas's reign in the mid-19th century, because you had the what they called the Cantonists, where every community had to produce a certain amount of Jews, and of course, as Jews were produced. That is, the community forced the poor Jewish kids to go to the army, not the rich ones or the children of Talmid Chachamim. Later on, you didn't have, it was more of random. Sometimes there was a draft, sometimes there wasn't a draft. It wasn't so scary as it was in earlier years. In any event, the Sipor couldn't get out of it, and he went into the army, and there are all sorts of legends of him during this time. I don't think any of them would be true, because I can't imagine the Sipor ever telling these stories. And some of them are clearly legendary. They talk about how on Shabbos he would shoot with the wrong hand, and that this was reported in the newspapers, all sorts of crazy stuff, as you can expect in hagiographies. He leaves the army, and soon matters become intolerable under the communists. There still was a thought that Judaism could thrive under communism. Had important figures there. You had the Bragoysker Rebbe, Rav Shemaya Noach Schneerson. You had a number of important Lubavitch figures there. You had non-Lubavitch rabbis in the early years, 1919, 20, 21. I mean, Ramosha Feinstein, we know he's there already into the 20s, late 20s. But it was becoming intolerable. In fact, it was Jewish communists who were doing their part to make it intolerable. And the Navardic students, behind Soviet lines, begin to secretly cross the border, escape over the border into Poland. Poland, after World War I, is now a country. It's a new country. This was not a very difficult task. Lots of people did it. All you needed to do was have a good guide. A good guide could take you across. At this time in 1921, there was still the Soviets were not concerned with people crossing the border. They were busy. They were still fighting the White Army. They had all sorts of Tsarist loyalists. Many of you have seen why is it escaping? escaping me the movie. Alaris theme. Someone will type it in. Which just portrays early action with Warren. The other movie that I'm hoping someone will type it in. His name is a movie, the one who's almost just not remind you of what movie about here. One of the greatest movies of the 20th century. You get a sense of what it was like in those earlier years. Dr. Zhivago, thank you. Some 600 students from Novartek and its satellite yeshivas crossed the border into Poland in the mid-1930s. Yes, thank you. Thank you for correcting me. You're right. Promotion was lucky to get out. Many great sages never got out. It was impossible, and we don't know what became of them. They died. They were sent to Siberia. That was the end of them. And, but pretty much most, pretty much all the Hasidic Rebbes were able to get out. The Ribnitzer Rebbe, I believe, only got out in the 1960s. But this is quite unusual. Almost everyone was able to get out. Rechesko Abramsky. I was thinking of Rechesko Abramsky. He got out. It was 1930, maybe, 31. Could have been, I think those were the years. In those years, you could still get out. But after that, you couldn't. So the yeshiva was reestablished in Poland with the center in Bialystok, and again, branches throughout the country eventually, and we're talking now just from 1921 to 1939, the Novartek yeshiva is the by far the most successful Torah institution in Poland, or in all of Eastern Europe, I'd say in the entire world, it's the most successful Torah institution. Eventually, there are 70 different yeshivas, that is the main yeshiva in Bialystok and satellite branches, and some 3,000 students. Now, I know today, I think they say that in the Mir or in Lakewood, you might have 3,000 students, but this is unheard of until recent years. And Novartek had 3,000 students under the Novartek banner. It was also in Poland that the Cypher married in 1927. The bride was the sister of Rav Avraham Shaya Karelitz, the Chazon Ish. In 1927, the Chazon Ish, and this is the period he's studying. Is he studying with Grada? He might be done studying with Grada. I think by then he might be finished. I have to check the dates. Yeah, Grada stopped studying at 23, and Grada is born before. But the Chazon Ish is still not known. He's still an unknown figure. There were some people who knew him. Shaul Lieberman has an essay in which he describes the Chazon Ish in Minsk. Chazon Ish, because Lieberman was his first cousin. The Chazon Ish's mother and Lieberman's mother were sisters. He knew him. Ramosha Rosen, who was the Rav of the city, the Chazon Ish, now, who then comes to America. He's known as the Nezer HaKodesh. He knew who the Chazon Ish was. He learned with him, but the world doesn't know who the Chazon Ish is. And we had the classes on the Chazon Ish. We spoke about how the Chazon Ish's first books were even written anonymously. But the Chazon Ish was obviously still a great man, even if he wasn't known. And according to the popular story, which I assume is true, it was the Chazon Ish himself who arranged the match. Supposedly, he was impressed with the Sipor's book, Shari Tvuna. It's the Sipor's first published work, published in 1925. When the Chazon Ish then met him, he suggested the match. The Chazon Ish had a sister, and although it was not known at the time, marrying into the family of the Chazon Ish would be the ticket later on for the Sipor to move into upper echelons of Haredi society. That doesn't mean that he might not have done it on his own, but especially in the Haredi world, Yichus, and who you're connected with, says a good deal about you in that world. Soon after the marriage, the Sipor is offered the position of Rosh Yeshiva in Israel, or in Eretz Yisrael, Palestine. Before that, he's offered the position of Rosh Yeshiva in Pinsk. They opened the Novartek Yeshiva in Pinsk, and there was approximately 200 students studying there. And he stays there about 8 years, until 1934, and it's then that he moves to the land of Israel because he was invited to lead the Novartek Yeshiva that had opened in Bnei Brak. Now, why leave? Why not stay in Pinsk? Well, first of all, the opportunity to live in the land of Israel is very important. Second of all, the opportunity to be near his brother-in-law, the Chazon Ish. That was an opportunity he couldn't give up. In fact, he lived in the same house as the Chazon Ish for a number of years. This is a heaven-sent opportunity. It was during this period in B'nai Brak, Steifer becomes identified with the Chazon Ish. And in every single matter, the Steifer sees himself as subordinate to the Chazon Ish, as following the Chazon Ish's path. So it's almost like a younger sibling. Anything the Chazon Ish says, that to him is Torah Misinai. If the Chazon Ish adopted a certain stringency, then the Steifer would adopt it. If he observed the Chazon Ish acting in a lenient fashion, not being concerned about something, then in his mind, there's no longer any need to be concerned about this. And once the Chazon Ish had passed on, Steifer saw himself as bereft of a guide and matters, and you can see this clearly in his writing, matters that could be easily clarified in previous years. After all, just ask Urim v'Tumim, ask the Chazon Ish, and there you'll know the answer. With the Chazon Ish no longer there, Steifer is now with all these things are matters of doubt. It's unclear. It was also in those years, after living in the land of Israel, not just after the Chazon Ish passes away, even before, reputation grows, slow grow. A couple of years after his arrival, the first volume of his Talmudic commentary, Kilos Yaakov, appeared. In the years after the war, Yehuda Kav Weinberg actually writes to the land of Israel asking to have it sent to them. Now, this, there's all sorts of legends itself about this book. Anyone who studied in Israel when the Steifer was alive and you wanted the book, you couldn't buy it in Sfarim stores. You didn't sell it. There's different explanations. Some say he wanted to cut out the middleman so he could get the money. He was obviously quite a poor man. Others that he wanted to make sure that the people who bought it were serious. The point is he had to go to the house and buy it. And if the Steifer was home, you actually had to buy it from the Steifer. Usually buy it from the Steifer. And that, if you know the Steifer, could be a terrifying experience because he didn't suffer fools kindly. But that he began to, now you can buy the whole book, the whole set, but he began to publish his book. This would be followed by subsequent volumes, many subsequent volumes, and these became standard books in the Haredi yeshiva, the Lithuanian yeshiva, in the curriculum. Together with this, he also published three volumes, Shirin D'Oraita, Eifat Tzedek, and Shirin Shel Torah, all of which devoted to the proper sizes and measurements required by Jewish law. Why did he do this? This is part of his task, of his identification with the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish, as I'm sure most of you know, one of his novelties, his innovations, is updating or changing the traditional sizes and measurements. It really goes back to the Note of Yehuda. The Note of Yehuda looked at the measurements and concluded he took an egg and all these things, and now. It's funny that the his student, the Tshuva Me'ava of Eliezer Fleckels, and those who plan to come with us to Prague this summer, we will stand at the kever of the Note of Yehuda. I'll talk a good deal, but we will also stand at the kever of the Tshuva Me'ava. I saw that most people don't even know where the Tshuva Me'ava is. They walk around, they go right to the Note of Yehuda. That is, those who go to the Note of Yehuda. Very few people go to the Note of Yehuda because it's a different cemetery. Everyone goes to the main cemetery in Prague. That is one of the top sites in Prague for Jews and non-Jews alike. It might even be the most visited site in Prague. But they stopped burying people there in the late century. 2 years after that, the Note of Yehuda passes, and he's buried in the other cemetery. There's a whole story. I'll tell the whole story. But the Tshuva Me'ava, Eliezer Fleckels, is buried there, and he records that the reason the Note of Yehuda came to such a big shiurim is because the Note of Yehuda was so tall. And we know the Note of Yehuda is quite tall, especially for his time. There's a whole literature on whether the Tshuva Me'ava, actually, if I'm not mistaken, the Tshuva Me'ava quotes the Note of Yehuda as smiling. He tells us to the Note of Yehuda, and the Note of Yehuda smiles. That's my recollection. And there's a whole literature on whether this is meant as a joke, that is, that the Note of Yehuda is actually acknowledging that you're right, don't take my shurim seriously, I'm bigger than everyone else, or not. In any event, this had no effect, the Note of Yehuda. So the Chazon Ish comes around, and it's the literature again, and concludes, like the Note of Yehuda, that our sizes should be bigger. He publishes his writings, and slowly a revolution begins, and it hasn't conquered the entire world, but it has conquered certainly much of the yeshiva world. When I say it hasn't conquered the entire world, just last week, Rav Avadi Yosef, in his public shiurim, which is widely reported, he stated that the Chazon Ish is wrong, it's a mistake, the Chazon Ish, he spoke very strongly, the Chazon Ish doesn't know what he's talking about here. Let me explain to you why he means the Chazon Ish doesn't know what he's talking about, because Rav Avadi Yosef's point is that there's a tradition in the land of Israel, going back hundreds and hundreds of years, of how these measurements should be. And therefore, it's a reform to come and say all of a sudden we're going to have different shiurim. What does that say about all the great rabbis? He uses going back to the Rambam, he says. But Rav Avadi Yosef was not the first one. There was a Rav Rav Na'eh, who was a Chabad background, and he defended. This really became a dispute between Bnei Brak and Jerusalem. He defended the old measurements. He was Ashkenazi. And the books that the Sipor wrote, the three I just mentioned, were written in opposition to Rabbi Na'eh in defense of his brother-in-law, the Chazon Ish, and the dispute became quite sharp. In fact, it's said that the Sipor regretted the sharp language he used. I mean, from the Sipor standpoint, how can anyone argue with the Chazon Ish? And he wouldn't tolerate that. And from Rav Na'eh's standpoint, how can anyone, even as great as the Chazon Ish, who just comes to the land of Israel, decide that what we're doing is wrong? We have a Masorah here, a tradition here. Let me look at the questions here. No. I know he said it as a joke. I'm not sure what you mean, William. Clarify. The question is, was his smiling at the Shuvah Me'ava an acknowledgement that you shouldn't take seriously his point about the Shiurim because he was bigger than everyone else, or was it just a cute comment? I think that's what they debate. He was smiling at the cuteness of the comment, not that he was taking it seriously, though. That's the debate in the literature. Is that William? Is this Dr. Bill? Bill Gewurz? That is. I know William knows a lot about these matters, so... Yeah, you see, he meant it literally. No, I believe. I agree with you. If you didn't have the Shuvah Me'ava, you wouldn't even raise the question. But some people have raised the question. And you're right. He put it in his commentary. He was explaining it. Nothing to his stature. He did measurements. If I'm not mistaken, he took eggs. He measured the size of eggs and all this sort of thing. But still, people have tried to read it differently. Okay, because of his connection to the Chazon Ish, it was only natural that after his passing, 1953, the Sipor would assume a more prominent role, because now the Sipor is carrying on this tradition of the Chazon Ish. Furthermore, the Brisker Rav, Yitzhak Zev Soloveitchik, he had great confidence in the Sipor, and that helped in this regard. Yet it still was a number of years before he became a leading voice, or even especially the leading voice in the Lithuanian Torah world. It's during the next 20 years, especially in the 1970s, late 1960s, precisely at the time that the Lithuanian yeshiva world is exploding, their population is increasing. In the 1950s, what was the yeshiva world? It was nothing. And by the early 1970s, it really starts increasing. The late 1970s, you really have a force. His reputation, his stature, is increasing at the very same time that the yeshiva world begins to explode in population. Now, not all Haredim think alike. We have to be careful about using the term Haredim, and it probably would be helpful in dividing them into different types of Haredim. You have American Haredim, you have Sephardic Haredim, you have Ada Haredi types, you have Lubavitch and other Hasidic groups, you have the Lithuanian yeshiva, Haredim, you have briskers with different outlooks, and many of them are at each other's throats, that they think completely different about different and about all sorts of things. And yet they choose to put themselves in they all choose to call themselves Haredim. Not all Haredim think alike. The Sipor would choose to dominate a certain branch of this community, what we call the Lithuanian sector. know, he himself, as we know, is not from Lithuania, but he studied in the Lithuanian yeshivas. He becomes that sector. In particular, that version, that branch of the Lithuanian sector that was very hesitant, the most hesitant to make any changes in what you could call, let's say, tradition. While certain changes were, of course, sanctioned, these always came from the community's gedolim. And regarding this community, I think it's fair to say that any suggested change, if it does not have the imprimatur, does not come from within the Haredi movement of the Haredi gedolim, the Haredi leadership, and have the imprimatur, it will be in opposition. It will be rejected as being in opposition to Das Torah of the gedolim. And last semester, we spoke about something, and someone emailed me, David Zilberberg. I was going to talk about it in a future class, but it just occurs to me now, so I'll mention it. We are talking about innovations in one of the classes about feminist innovations. And he emailed me about this business, which I didn't know much about. I heard about it, but I looked into it. We have these things called Amen groups. I have his email here. Where Haredi women, they even have something in Jewish Action. They get together and they recite brachos, they reply Amen. And that's apparently, some of you maybe can comment on it, is big in the Haredi world. I am certain that the Haredi men don't think it's important and don't take it seriously. If they did, the men would do it. However, I guess they see this as an outlet for the women. After all, you can't have the women, if the women feel they need some sort of spiritual depth in their life, they need to be doing something spiritually, you have to give them something. Otherwise, maybe they'll want to learn Gemara, they'll want to listen to Torah in Motion classes, they'll want to go to Yeshiva University Sunday morning thing for women. They'll want, in other words, to keep them in the community, you see, they need to be given something, so they have these Amen groups. Now, David points out, and he's absolutely correct, had this been started in the modern Orthodox world, get together and you say brachos and you say Amen or anything like that, this would be decried as an innovation. Brachos, who ever heard of this? Getting together and saying Amen? What kind of nonsense is this, they would say? Who ever heard of something so crazy? The same thing they say about all the things that the modern Orthodox do. But the fact that this originated in the Haredi world and has been given approval by the Gedolim, that means that it's kosher. Very important in that world. That's what determines whether it's kosher. You can't argue based on logic and how does this differ from anything else. The big difference is if the Haredi Gedolim say that it's acceptable, then it's acceptable. If they don't say it's acceptable, then it's not acceptable. Daf Yomi is acceptable. Rambam Yomi is not acceptable. Yarchei Kala and Ponevesh is acceptable. Hakel, Zecher Hakel, set up by the Rabbanut, is not acceptable. Kina, which the Aguda puts forth for the Holocaust, that's acceptable. The Kina that the Chief Rabbinate puts out is not acceptable. That's how they function. It's not a question of being inconsistent. It's a question of that they, any changes are only valid when it's put forth by their authority figures. That's what it comes down to at the end of the day. And all the propaganda by people like Avi Shachrin, that we don't believe in this and that, it's all nonsense. They believe in what the Gedolim tell them. If the Gedolim say that this is what you do, that's what you do. And that makes perfect sense to me. Much more sense than any of the apologists who are trying to explain the Haredi world. The Haredi world is based on the decisions of the Gedolim. Avi Shachrin doesn't know what the Gedolim are going to say. So they say it. So at the end of it, that's what it is. And the Haredi Gedolim determine that certain innovations are acceptable and others are not. It's as simple as that. His center of influence was in Israel, in particular in Bnei Brak, but also in Jerusalem, and as time goes on, throughout the whole world. Those people seeking Das Torah, that is Lithuanian Das Torah, if you're a Ger Chassid, you go to the Ger Rebbe. If you're someone else, you go to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. But if you're from the Yeshiva world, and you want a real Haredi Das Torah, there are a couple of people you could ask. You probably couldn't ask for Moshe Feinstein, but you could ask the Stiper. The Stiper would give you Das Torah. He published, they published letters of his, in which letter after letter is explaining what the Haredi Das Torah is. And I give numerous examples. Just one that sticks off the top of my head right now. I was looking through the book, his book of letters. So there's a school in Amsterdam. And they didn't, you know, they're establishing yeshiva, and they don't know how much secular education because the parents insist, the government insists. So what to do? You write to the stipler, and the stipler will tell you what to do. And of course, the stipler says minimize secular education as much as possible. I'm getting an email sent to me that the Maharam Mintz has a tshuva where he says that the Rabbanim in his time refrained from learning Torah and Beis Yosef because it was Balabakish. It's funny you mention this because the Chazon Ish is relevant to the story, and Rav Avadya Yosef quotes this. In Pera Dor, the biography of the Chazon Ish, it talks about how the Chazon Ish people would make fun. The Chazon Ish would sit in this base medrash all day learning, and what would he be learning? He'd be learning Torah and Beis Yosef. And people would make fun of him, because that's not the Lithuanian method, that's not the Yeshiva method. You learn Gemara, you learn Rambam, you learn Svaras, all these things. And the moral of the story is, look what became of the Chazon Ish, look what became of them. The Chazon Ish became who he became, and Rav Avadya Yosef, in a number of places, trying to show that his approach is the proper approach, that is, learning for the sake of practical halacha, quotes this story, because it really is a story of how the Chazon Ish broke with the yeshiva world. The Chazon Ish was never adherent of the yeshiva method of learning, the yeshiva method of Talmud study, the Brisker method. And so Rav Avadya quotes this story that the Chazon Ish focused on Torah and Beis Yosef, which were thought, not, they weren't really regarded as so much Balabatish, because the Balabatim, at least maybe in the Maharam Mintz, was different, but in the 19th century, early 20th century, Balabatim were not studying that. It was thought to be something, if you're going to be a rug, you need to learn it. But that's not, it's a technical thing. You want to be a technocrat, you have to learn what the halacha is. But that's not how you develop yourself into a gadol, because you're all sitting and learning dry halachot. You have to learn Tosos and Rambam and this, and that's your focus on. And obviously the Chazon Ish learned that also. But the fact that he would spend hours learning practical type of halacha, which was not the yeshivish approach, that's why that story is relevant. Rav Avadya emailed this to me, not Glenn, sorry, and he mentions that Rav Osner brings this in his tshuva as well. So thank you very much. There's lots of things that the Rabbanim wouldn't study. They wouldn't study drashos. You write about that, and they wouldn't study Torah Shegachtav even. But that wasn't because it was Balavakish. That was because they thought it would lead to Haskalah, things like that. If you go back to 1920, basically what you had is you had, in every community, you had people who were learned, who studied Gemara, people who had studied Yeshiva for a while. You'd have a Gemara Shir, and then you'd have Chevra Mishnayos, and Yaakov, and Chevra Tehillim. It's not like today. Most people were ignorant. Today we have Daf Yomi, we have all sorts of people who want to study it. In those days, Gemara was an elitist thing, and people studied other things, and so it's a very different world. Well, he didn't write a glossary. Glossary means is like a dictionary. He wrote glosses. These were published. Some quite critical. You see that they really start from different perspectives. We spoke about it in the classes on the Chazon Ish. Whether he intended for these to be published is unclear. There are some people who were upset when these appeared. I don't know why he should be upset. The Chazon Ish, anything the Chazon Ish writes, I would think we want to learn from. And so what? So he gives criticism of Reb Chaim. So he has a different approach to it. Isn't that something that we should learn from? But yes, he does have criticisms of it, and he had criticisms, verbal criticisms of the yeshiva method of learning. He loved the yeshiva world. They would come visit him all the time, but yet that was not his method of learning, and Reb Chaim's method of learning was not his, and he never studied in Volozhin. Chazon Ish is one of those figures. He never studied in the yeshiva. The Soloveitchik never studied. People who don't study in yeshivas, or Fritzog never studied in yeshiva, they often develop differently. They're not bound to certain models, and I find it hard to believe that had the Chazon Ish studied in yeshiva, he would have been the Chazon Ish, because he would have been made into a conventional type of person. His learning method would have been turned to convention. This way, he's studying on his own. And they say that he'd study, the first thing he'd do is he'd learn the Gemara without the Rashi. Just learn the Gemara, try to figure it out. I mean, he did it his own way, figured it out his own way, and that's what made him the Chazon Ish. No. Seifer never publicly disagreed with the Pesach of the Chazon Ish. I will give you an example where it appears that he disagrees, but he would not say he disagrees. never disagrees, at least in all that I've read, that includes five volumes of the Orchos, of the sayings and the doings and the writings of the Stipler, and then two more volumes of his letters, I have not found one place where not only does he not disagree with him, he never even says it's difficult, it's problematic. Maybe there is such a place, but I have no recollection of ever seeing it. Chazon Ish was literally the Urim Vatumim to him. Yeah, I mean, you can see a good treatment is Lawrence Kaplan's great article on the Chazon Ish. He has a wonderful analysis of the Chazon Ish's criticism of the Brisker approach. I mean, one thing he throws in, he quotes someone who says that the Chazon Ish judged Reb Chaim by the wrong criteria. He judged Reb Chaim whether Reb Chaim was giving the original intent of the Rambam. But he explains, it makes sense as to why, what the problems the Chazon Ish had with, not just with Reb Chaim, with Musar, with other things. So, but the Stipler now was took over, and as I mentioned, that's my last class. The guy from the Kol Chazon Ish, who I spent Shabbos with, their opposition to the Stipler was that the Stipler's method of learning, not the Chazon Ish's method of learning. Now, when the Stipler said, getting back to the point I said to Amsterdam, you know, don't have secular studies as much as you can, get rid of it. This is obviously what we would expect the Stipler to say. I offer it only to give you a glimpse of how he was already being called upon to influence events around the globe. And you see this in his letters. And it wasn't only traditional, it wasn't only as a traditional love, as a repository of Das Torah that people turn to him with their problems. He begins to assume the role of a tzaddik, a holy man, much like a Hasidic Rebbe who has clairvoyant powers. The Chazon Ish in his lifetime never was regarded like this. You don't have Lithuanian Gedolim regarded like this. Maybe after their life you could have some stipler about the Chazon Ish. Stipler is the only, now his son has assumed that to a certain extent, the Stipler in his lifetime was treated as a holy man, a man with Ruach HaKodesh, just like a Chassid Sherebi, one who will give brachas, one who isn't, has certain special abilities. And the Stipler never really shied away from this. And this is perhaps, I would say, presumably, his Hasidisha background coming to the fore here, that this is what he grew up with, and he sees this as a part of what it means to be a spiritual leader. The Chazon Ish himself spoken about how in every generation there are those who are blessed with Ruach HaKodesh. Still today. And it became very popular to regard the Stipler himself as one who falls into this category. And there are many stories of the Stipler's Ruach HaKodesh. Just look in that five-volume book I mentioned, the stories about the Stipler, and you'll see all sorts of what they call mosim and real Ruach HaKodesh, where he sees things that other people can't see. These are not the typical stories, and literally you don't find these stories. Occasionally you'll get maybe a story here and there, but you don't usually have stories like this. With the Stipler, you have these stories. He did not function, though, as a posek. He functioned as a leader, not as a posek. For psak, for general questions of psak, they were dayanim you go to. His machutim, Rav Yashiv. Yeah, he was a posek. He would send people who had questions. If you have a question on Shabbos or something like this, you can go to the posek. Big questions he decides about. So these larger questions he's dealing with, not the smaller ones. But there still were times that he did deal in practical halakha. Or maybe he regarded these as big questions. For example, there are lengthy, lengthy discussions in the literature about abortion. When is it permissible? When is it not? When is it forbidden? I hope to eventually do classes on the Tzitzel Yenzer. We'll speak about his view of abortion, or Moshe Feinstein's view of abortion, and many others, the Sri Deish, and there's tshuvas, long, long tshuvas, where Moshe Feinstein's responds on abortion is a very, very long one. Stipler was asked this question. And his answer, published in his collected writings, disposes of the issue in one paragraph. Doesn't quote any of the halakhic literature. pages and pages. I mean, you go, if anyone was doing a tshuva on abortion, you have Tosfos, you have two different Tosfos, you have a famous tshuva, you have the Chavos Yair, you have classic Yair, Yaakov Emden, classic tshuvos about abortion. Obviously, you have the Rambam. What does the Rambam mean? It's a very difficult Rambam that deals with abortion. He seems to say that the fetus is a rotzeach. I mean, David Feldman in his book on abortion and marital relations, Jewish law, gives, I think it's 25 or 26 different explanations on what the Rambam means from the different responsa literature. Slaypur in one paragraph. That shows he's not really a posek. In one paragraph, he disposes of the issue and he says that it is obvious, pashut me'od, those are his words, that other than danger to the mother's life, physical danger, all abortion is strictly forbidden. But this is not the mainstream view. This is not the view of most poskim. This is the view of Moshe Feinstein, but that's a minority position. Most, if you look at the Ma'arit and all the different tshuva, first of all, many of them give psychological reasons as a reason for having an abortion. There's all sorts of things. For him, he says, danger to the mother's life. Strict position, and he doesn't feel the need to justify it. That's Das Torah, I guess you could say. He gives his Das Torah that abortion's forbidden, and it's obvious, he says. I mean, it's not, I don't know what to say. It's not obvious to all the other poskim who deal with it. On the contrary, it's quite it's difficult to understand what the halacha on abortion is. Ovadi emails me that he heard from a well-known Rav and Posek today that the Sniper had a Ruach HaKodesh. That's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. It's hard to see the Sniper's decision on abortion as dictated by the halakha literature alone. I want to conclude that's what the halakha is. It's not Pashut Ma'od at all. And especially as the Sniper doesn't deal with these sources, I don't think it's a stretch to say that here we have an example of a real general conservatism of the Sniper determining halacha. And maybe perhaps a tinge of this idea that you shouldn't even argue about these matters. It's so obvious. If you start, we've spoken about this with Chaim Moser when he dealt with stunning animals before Shlita. This is also the position of the Chazon Ish when it came to electricity. Don't even argue the issue. Because if you start arguing it and start going back and forth to different positions, people then assume that there's a possibility that there's a heter for certain circumstances. And the answer is there is no heter. It's absolutely positively forbidden, so just say that it's forbidden. That's what Das Torah is. Just say it's forbidden. No discussion, no arguments. I think that's what the disciple is doing in that. But it's hard to see such a person as a halachist, a posek, because the whole idea of a posek is to discuss these matters, and truthfully, this is different than electricity or stunning prior to Shlita. Electricity was a new phenomenon. So the only people arguing would have been contemporary poskim. So the Chazon Ish can say to all the contemporary poskim, don't say anything, just say it's usher. But abortion is an issue that, you can't just say Yaakov Emden's a nobody. You don't argue his position, the Chavos Yair is a nobody. I mean, you have great poskim in the previous years, Rishonim and Acharonim, who deal with this issue. So it's really not parallel, but I think that's what the Sniper's position was. A similar example of this great conservatism, deals with, he was asked about becoming a doctor. Can you be a doctor? A lot of problems. Now, this is an issue that's been dealt with at great length, and yet the Sniper declares, without discussing any of the sources or anything like that, quote, it is virtually impossible, he says, to be a doctor and properly observe halacha. You shouldn't be a doctor. Well, what's the problem? Well, first of all, doctors must deal with women as male doctors who are sick. And the disciple says, since we now have women doctors, he's not just referring to gynecologists, he's referring to all doctors. Since you can find a woman doctor for all sorts of things, therefore, it's very difficult to find have permission for a male doctor to treat these women. And, he doesn't say, the assumption is, be a doctor and just be for men. But he realizes that this will never happen. If you're going to be a doctor, you're going to treat everyone. And therefore, since being a doctor means you treat men and women, today you can't be a doctor. And he says also even if it's a circumstance where there is no female doctor, find, I guess, a heter for a male doctor to treat, he says, quote, it is impossible, that's his word, impossible for a doctor to avoid improper thoughts when treating a woman. And therefore, a doctor. Furthermore, he says that it's very difficult for doctors to observe Shabbos properly. Because, as he says, it is forbidden to violate Shabbos to treat the wicked Jews. Who are the wicked Jews? Category in which he includes most of the secularists. Now, this is exactly the sort of thing that Art Scroll will not include in their book on the Stipler. The Stipler holds a halacha l'maisa. It is forbidden for an Orthodox Jew to treat a non-Orthodox Jew on Shabbos. And he's referring to most non-Orthodox Jews, the overwhelming majority of non-Orthodox Jews, as I will explain. Here's an example of what I mentioned at the very first class, that you're going to have certain positions of him which have a long pedigree, make perfect sense in the context he's saying them, but are not in line with the American Haredi perspective and therefore would not be mentioned. And as I said, in the Nartzker biography, the Stipler has a very negative view of the non-Orthodox, which is in complete contradiction to the American Haredi perspective. The American Haredi perspective is all about Kirov. Everyone's a Tinok Shenishma. They don't know any better. We have to bring everyone back. This is not the Stipler's position. In fact, reading his letters, it is often hard to see any difference between his outlook and that of the Satmar Rav on a whole range of issues. And I'll come back to his view of the non-religious in a minute. Since I just mentioned the Satmar, let me explain what I mean. It's true that the Stipler insists that his followers vote in elections. You have probably 20 different letters in his collected letters saying who to vote for, that you have to vote, just like Rav Shach did. And Rav Shach basically relates to the Stipler like the Stipler relates to the Chazon Ish. I haven't found any real difference between them. And yet, there is no happiness about the state of Israel, about the existence of the state of Israel. He continuously attacks the, quote, the idol of Zionism. He attacks efforts by the chief rabbinate to organize world Jewry, all sorts of things. He is very different than the Haredim in Jerusalem. Remember what I said last time, someone like Rabbi Yehuda Cook, who had very close relationships with people like Rabbi Yechezkel Sarnon, the people in Jerusalem, even though they were Haredim, Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky, he had no relationships and could not relate at all to someone like the Stipler. It was just a total different worldview. The Stipler's disagreement with the anti-Zionists, with the Satmar, is only in the way of tactics, not in the way of any basic ideological divide. The Stipler is in line with the Satmar position. This is also not found in Art Scroll. And here is an area where, as far as I know, the Chazon Ish never expressed himself, and I have no reason to think that the Chazon Ish agreed with the Stipler in this view. As far as I know, the Chazon Ish never expressed himself the way the Stipler did, strong as he did. It's more in line with the Brisker Rav. For the Stipler, and for those in his camp, the state exists. It has to be dealt with. He rejects, he has correspondence with the Ada Haredi and others. He doesn't, him, for him it makes no sense. That's for the Stipler. Just like in Poland, you have to deal with the government, so too in the land of Israel. You have to deal with the government. In Poland, you had Jewish deputies, so in Israel you have Jewish deputies. For him, like the Chazon Ish, recognition of the state is a fact on the ground, and the goal is pragmatic coexistence. And he and Rav Shach and the Chazon Ish, they never could grasp this idea that on matters of principle, you have nothing to do with the state. Why shouldn't you? We live in the state, we pay taxes, why should we get money for our taxes? Why shouldn't we be involved to try to help our communities? Yet, despite this pragmatic coexistence, there is nothing positive Stipler can see in the state. It's an ideological motif. Avies Zoravitsky, who's written about this, has termed, quote, Galut Yisrael Be'eretz HaKodesh. That is, we are in exile in the state of Israel. In this conception, none of the state's actions are deserving of praise. His suspicion of the state's motives is such that he even assumed that the Yom Kippur War was brought on by the labor government as a ploy to boost its election chances. This is a conspiracy theory, if there ever was a conspiracy theory. Sounding no different. And this will be the last paragraph I'll mention. We'll pick up more on this when we return. It'll be very troubling, I know, for people. I take my word for it. Sounding no different than the Satmar Rav, the Stipor went so far as to say, and this is all either written down by himself or by his students, the Stipor went so far as to say that the Golus in the state of Israel is worse than the Golus under the non-Jews in previous generations. It is worse to live in the land of Israel under the Zionists than it is to live in Poland or anywhere else. Why? Because the Poland and elsewhere were not with Jewish religious life. In fact, if you can believe the report, one of his students, Avraham Horovitz, he's very close to the Stipor, and his works have the approval of the Stipor's son, he reports that the Stipor said it would be better for Jews to remain in the Soviet Union than come to the land of Israel. They come to the state of Israel, because in the state of Israel, they will be entirely turned against Judaism. And we've seen the Satmar say this about don't leave Yemen and come to the state of Israel, but at least in Yemen, you can be Jewish. In the Soviet Union, you can't be Jewish at all. But this is an example, and I don't know, I think it's fair to say, I don't know whether it's hard for me to imagine that the Stipor would make they say this in the 1970s. Early 80s when he's still alive. It's one thing to say in the 50s and 60s, but by the 1970s, the state of Israel was the center of Torah. Government was supporting Torah institutions. More Torah institutions were being supported by the Israeli government than anywhere, and even if you don't like the government, the fact is that it was in terms of Torah institutions, that was the place to be. So I can imagine him saying that in the 1950s, when you had all these people, you know, the people, the boys from Tehran who came, that is Jews from Europe who came from Tehran, and then what happened with the Sephardim, how they were immediately placed in the irreligious environment. That I can believe he said in the 50s. I really can't believe it he said later. But this is the anti-Zionist topos, the classic anti-Zionist topos, that the state of Israel is worse for Judaism than life in the diaspora, meaning, and the Stipor agrees with this, it would have been better for the state of Israel never to have been established. This is not what most Haredim think. Most Haredim think that the Zionists did terrible things, but at the end of the day, it's better that we have a state, and now we can make the state Haredi, or whatever they say, religious. But the idea that it would be better for the state never to have been established, that is a Satmar-like position. We saw Rav Henkin held that position, but this is a very unusual position in the Lithuania Haredi world. The mainstream Lithuania Haredi world supported the establishment of the state. We spoke about this, especially after the Holocaust. So next week when we return, we'll deal with more of these sorts of views of the Stipor. In fact, we will see how the Stipor deals with the Chazon Ish's more liberal position when it comes to relations with the irreligious. Stipor held that all the irreligious today are Tino Shnishva. They don't know any better. Stipor rejects this. So we will see how he does that. And then we'll move into other issues where, despite this, the Stipor becomes a great, if we can use the term, liberal in his argument with Rabbi Menashe Klein. And had the Stipor adopted a different position, it would have been the end of Lithuanian, of Yeshiva Kirov. The Stipor was one that ruled in a way that allowed Lithuanian Yeshiva world Kirov really go forward, and that's where we will pick up. I don't know if next class will be the last one. Maybe we'll have a little more, but we are really in the heart of the Stipor now. If you have questions or comments? The Stipor, Rav Shach, all of them have letters and negative comments about psychologists. They were all convinced that psychologists, they were convinced it was a waste of time. First of all, that I think they maybe had some tolerance for from psychologists as a Rabbi Lifshitz, but if you read the way they write about psychologists, they think that the psychologists, they know a bit about Freud. They think psychologists are all about turning people against religion. And it is certainly, from their perspective, forbidden to go to a non-religious psychologist. a religious psychologist, if it's a Haredi psychologist, and they've been understood to be kosher, that I know from just the way that world lives, that already they can find permission for. But psychology, the field of psychology, is viewed very negatively by the Stipler and that whole world, because they see, what is Freud? They see Freud as psychology as go to them and you're unhappy, so don't observe Torah anymore. Having said that, we know that in the Lithuanian Haredi world, there were certain figures, psychologists, who Haredi Gedolim, even in this camp, did send people to. But when it comes to doctors, they don't care. They'll send it to any doctor if he's an expert. When it comes to psychologists, they will be very, very careful who they send it to, and I don't blame them. I mean, I don't think we can send, as religious Jews, we can go to any psychologist. I think that is quite dangerous. But the rhetoric against the field of psychology, the evil of psychology that you find in Haredi writings of Stipler of Shach and others, is worth noting. Ovadia, we will get to this point. Exactly what you're saying, I'm going to speak about next class. Remind me, but send email me, please, what exactly you're referring to. I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to. I think I know what you're referring to, but I'm not sure. But I will speak next class how, in practice, the Stipler diverges from the Chazon Ish and how he relates to the irreligious. But in theory, of course, because he can't diverge in theory, he accepts the Chazon Ish, he has to explain why in theory he's different. And it's a whole trend in the Haredi world. All these things I just mentioned about Art Scroll will not deal with them. And I think that shows how even the American Haredi world would not be able to stomach some of these more extreme things that doesn't fit into their outlook, especially with regard to the irreligious or about the state. So we're seeing different attitudes of her. Okay, I see a few more people typing. We'll hang on for a few more minutes. I think it's a testimony to the Stipler's greatness in so many ways that despite some of these views, which are positively abhorrent to the religious Zionist world and really not in line with how the American Haredi, or not just the American Haredi, even part of the Israeli Haredi world, don't feel, the fact that the Stipler, despite these views, was still regarded as an important, not just a halachic figure, for Moshe Sternbach. Moshe Sternbach is a halachic figure, even though he's an anti-Zionist. But I'm talking about the Stipler still was a spiritual leader. Everyone, the American Agudists, would go to the Stipler, even though in certain important areas they had different outlooks. That shows the significance of the Stipler. It's always hard, Yisrael asking, speculate what the Stipler might say. Kolal for everyone? He would say yes, kolal for everyone. Burkas? No. He would not. How could he approve of burkas? The Chazon Ish's wife didn't have a burka. The other ones, conversion, reversion, swimmers on water, all I know is that the Stipler was a big, very stringent on conversions, but on the other hand, he attacked Rav Gorin for revoking conversion. So it's very hard to say about any community, what a previous sage would do if they were here to speak about it. It's really impossible to speculate. And that's what these figures always surprise us. Now, I'm going to give you all the examples of the Stipler, and then I'll give you something which you never would have expected. So it really doesn't make sense to speculate. We do have a son of the Stipler, so we get a sense perhaps of what he would, but that's not perfect. I don't think, the Moshe Klein was not influenced by the Stipler at all. Not at all. Published a whole book on it, giving his position, and he has the Stipler's letters. He has letters in there from Rabin Yoman Zilber and others. He was not influenced. Moshe Klein is not one to be influenced. Did he say anything about the Holocaust? Other than the typical things in terms of, he does say that it was due to the reform. The reformers are the reason for the Holocaust. But other than that, nothing leaps to mind. No, the Stipler had Avadi asked about the Stipler. The Stipler had a cultural relationship with Menashe Klein. They had back and forth correspondence on this matter and other that we'll speak about the child of Anita and other matters also. But the Stipler wasn't convinced by Menashe Klein, and Menashe Klein wasn't convinced by the Stipler. Very rarely, to your question, Glenn, how often we have loads and loads of responsa literature full of correspondence between great sages back and forth. You really ever see that one Gadol is convinced by the other Gadol? No, they argue back and forth, and we read their literature and we study, and other people determine which one makes more sense. But the interlocutors, the ones who are arguing, it is almost unheard of for one of them to admit that they are wrong, say, you know, you've convinced me. It happens occasionally. There's a Sridei Eish where he admits publicly, and it said that the Chazon Ish, when he heard about this, because this was apparently was known earlier on, he said that this Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberger is one of the only sages who actually has the courage to acknowledge that he is mistaken, that he is wrong. But it's very, very unusual for a post-sage ever acknowledge that he's been convinced of the other side. That's to be expected. But the state, Menashe Klein has his own issues. It's not just with Bali Tshuva, it's with converts, it's with women, it's with everything. Let me tell you something interesting about Menashe Klein, though. And right now I'm preparing. We very much hope that we will be in Boscovitz this summer. So I'm speaking about Rav Nassim Adler. We're going to do classes. I'll deal with Rav Nassim Adler in a few classes when I deal with the Chasam Sofer. Rav Nassim Adler had all sorts of innovations. He was put in Chayrim. We spoke about this because of the unusual things he did. And one of his innovations was that women need to hear Parsha Zohar. So this event then... This is one of the only innovations, not Birkas Kohanim every day, not Sephardic pronunciation, or Nusach Ari, or anything else. This innovation of Renus and Adler took off and became popular so that today, our women, you know, we have a second reading before Mincha, we read Davening, we tell our women to hear Parsha Zachar. Okay. Masha Klein is such a traditionalist, so he's angry at everything. Everything in the yeshiva world today, I gave a talk on him. We had the conference in Budapest last year, if you remember, and my talk was on Rav Menashe Klein. So he looks at the yeshiva world today and he sees it's full of innovations, full of, his whole argument with the Stipler, he keeps going back to the point that in the Al-Kahane, in the old country, no one would ever dream of something like this, what you're telling me. So it's all tradition. So here he actually, when it comes to the Parsha Zachar, he says, no one in Hungary ever read Torah Parsha Zachar to women. What is this reform? So you see, he's so conservative that sometimes it works in opposition to what today is frum. Today, frumkeit, Menashe Klein is very much against frumkeit. He even uses the term frumkeit. He writes against frumkeit. Today, frumkeit is you tell the women that they have to hear Parsha Zachar. And from his perspective, that's another reform. That's not traditional. Traditional Judaism, whoever heard in the old country in Hungary, that the women will hear Parsha Zachar. So he said, get rid of this reform, get rid of all reforms. So in that sense, he's quite a fascinating figure. We'll deal more with Rav Nassim Adler very soon. Okay, I see there's no more questions. Thank you very much. If we missed anything, you want me to clarify, I am going to get to comments and emails even from last semester, those of you who are waiting. And some other things. Issues that are Soloveitchik, because Rashachtin never mentions Soloveitchik. Never mentions him. No relationship with him. No connection. Good night, everyone.